On this week's 51%, actor and comedian Allison Larkin explores how grief encouraged her to live and love more fully in her new memoir, Grief, a Comedy.
We can spend our time in an abject panic, or we can take some of that focus and look at the love.
We also stop by a Statsburg, New York art exhibit reflecting on loss, healing, and remembrance. I'm Jessie King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh leader. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessie King. Today we bring you a string of interviews and stories centered around loss and healing, starting with someone who takes a lighter look at it. Allison Larkin is an artist, comedian, voiceover artist, audiobook narrator, and producer based in Western Massachusetts. Once she reached her 50s and marriage, divorce, and parenting were all in the rearview mirror, Larkin figured love was something that more or less passed her by, and she was okay with that. And then, of course, she fell head over heels in love with a man named Bhima, also in his 50s, who had moved to America 30 years earlier. But 5 days after they decided to get married, Bhima suddenly died. Larkin says she was surprised to learn that the grief did not shut her up inside her home, but instead encouraged her to live and love more fully. She wrote an autobiographical show about the experience and took it on tour last year. Now she's got a book version called Grief, a Comedy. Larkin spoke with WAMC's Sarah LeDuc.
Well, I'm very pleased that it's out and that my task is complete. I don't know if you remember, but...
this task was set to you by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I do remember. But we should tell the people.
We should tell the hello people. Well, what happened was that I fell deeply in love in my 50s for the first time in my life. I had avoided love my whole life because I was afraid of the worst happening, possibly for adoption-related reasons. The key to dealing with a fear of abandonment is to date people you don't like. So if they do leave you, it doesn't matter. Then I fell in love in the Berkshires with a wonderful climate scientist from South India. And then he died. But then instead of wanting to give up, I found to my utter astonishment that I wanted to live and love more fully than ever, and I didn't understand it. And I had been friends with Archbishop Desmond Tutu 2 years before, and he found out what had happened and he emailed me. And he said, first of all, I want you to know that I have asked God to find you another soulmate. And she said she is on the case.
Mm-hmm.
But first, you must do everything you can to make sure that this story is told as widely as possible, because it will bring hope to a world that badly needs it. So you can't ignore Archbishop Desmond Tutu. So I wrote a show called Grief, a Comedy that previewed in the Berkshires, at Barrington Stage last summer, and then went to the Edinburgh Fringe and then went to London, and it sold out, and it was a hit. And it was a one-woman show.
Yes.
In which I told this story. And then I wrote a follow-up book also called Grief, a Comedy, which starts 6 weeks after Bhima died, when he showed up at my kitchen table, determined to help me find love again. It's imaginary, of course, or is it? And it has been a very long process doing my... I mean, you have to do what Archbishop Desmond Tutu tells you.
I think you do. One must. Well, I don't have any personal experience with it, of course, but it feels important.
He's a bit of a taskmaster. And it was hard work. But so the answer is I'm thrilled. And people are writing to me telling me that it is really helping them to find joy after loss. And I had an email yesterday from a woman that I didn't know well who had read it, who said that her husband died about 4 years ago, and that it gave her permission to find love again. And she's met somebody who she thinks she really may truly be in love with. And so I'm thinking, well, then it's been worth it.
What did you learn about the story, your story, and what you wanted to put to the page as you brought the show around the world ultimately?
I found out that everybody has deep loss. It wasn't just me.
Of course.
And I realized that in this world, which is so divided, perhaps it has never been more divided, we must find our common humanity. So there I am in Edinburgh and London doing this show about love. I mean, it's a comedy. It's about love. It's about loss. It's about finding great joy after loss and in the midst of pain. And there are all these people who have not necessarily identically the same story, but have also lost people. And I learned that I wasn't on my own. And we would go to the bar, as you do, after a show, and sort of speak with each other. And I would have people that I didn't know. I'd say to them, do you mind if I ask you if you have a continuing relationship with your loved one after they've died? And one person, a woman, bursts into tears and says, thank you so much for asking the question. And another woman says, well, I haven't talked about this before, but since you ask, my husband Wilf died 4 years ago, but I set the table every night for him and we have a right old chat. And suddenly there we are all talking about the fact that while it is true, of course, that the body goes, the love doesn't. And that we can, if we allow ourselves, connect with people who are no longer with us physically. And it's been exhilarating. And now I get to go on these podcasts and radio programs and I get to meet people who share the same experience. Now, I'm not a person who has ever been to a psychic, or I don't believe in mediums except as a dress size. I don't know about that stuff. But after Bhima died, I did feel a real connection and a sense of his presence. And so that's why I wrote a book in which he shows up as witty and charming as ever and came with me through the grieving process. And so I would have these imaginary conversations with him and I'd know exactly what he would say in any moment. And so, yeah, what I've learned is that this is quite common and it's called a continuing bond, and people are nervous about talking about it because people will think they're absolutely stark, raving bonkers. Mm-hmm. But we're not.
Your parents, your adoptive parents, but the parents who raised you, your family in England, and Bhima's family, both from the book, I can tell that they recognized the value of your relationship to each other. They were very excited for the two of you to have a future together. And they were very supportive of you as you were supportive of them, of course, as they went, Bhima's family, as they went through this loss. How do they feel about the book? What is everybody's reaction to the story being told and the show, of course, too?
Well, my father died.
I know.
I'm laughing because actually I think it's the same muscle, isn't it?
Laughing
the
and
muscle
crying.
That moves when you laugh and you cry. So Dad, who absolutely adored Bhima on sight, you know, Dad died in 2022. And my mother now, I'm sorry to laugh, is unfortunately unable to recognize anybody because she has Alzheimer's. So
I'm sorry.
All I know is she did read the book before a very early draft and she absolutely loved it. And Bhima's family, I just had a lovely message from his cousin. We all gathered because in the Hindu tradition, you gather after 5 years after somebody has died. And we all gathered together about a week and a half ago. And Bhima's cousin, who I'd heard so much about but hadn't met, wrote me an email saying that he listened to the audiobook of Grief, a Comedy, on his way back to San Francisco from New York, and that he tried not to laugh out loud because he thought he'd disturb the other sleepers, but that I think the word they used was it makes Beamer chim-cheery, which means that he will live forever. And he said, you have, in an endearing and enduring way, captured this extraordinary man. And now he knows what Beamer was doing in the last couple of years of his life. And he was very much in love. So they've been incredibly supportive. And they keep saying, yes, keep going, Alison, keep going. Because we do, I mean, I am finding the response, you know, I don't know, loss. Whether it be loss of a person, whether it be loss of a country, whether it be loss of anything, it is tricky. Now, we're all going through it every single day. And unfortunately, I'm just beginning to realise at my ripe old age that there's going to be tricky stuff every single day. You're going to have good days. You're going to have bad days. You're going to have good years and bad years. You're never going to get away from pain because that's part of life. But within the pain, you can always find joy. So I'm beginning to realise, I think part of what Tutu was trying to get out there was to sort of, you know, remind people that we can spend our time in an abject panic about whatever is going on, or we can take some of that focus and look at the love that is everywhere. At the people we love, at the sky, at the lake. We live in the Berkshires. We live in one of the most beautiful places in the world. If we are so focused on what is going on in the news 24/7, we might miss the heron or the red-tailed hawk that's being chased by all those sparrows that are so much smaller than it is. And we have a choice. And that's what Tutu said to me. And I'll never forget it. I can't control what happens to me, but I can control how I respond to it. And when we go, oh God, what am we going to do? I think we can remember that we are all human beings. And that was the other thing I learned from the show and also from response to the book, is that people who vote very differently from me, who think very differently from me, they have terrible loss too. And they also find ways to move forward and find ways to live and love again. And so I was talking with people of all different races, ages, backgrounds, and that's what's happening with the book. And I think perhaps when we're sitting there going, what can I do? Maybe the answer is look at what's around you that is beautiful. Focus on that. Focus on the love, connect, and try and find the common humanity with people we vehemently disagree with, because that's the antidote to division.
I also experienced the book on audio. I listened to your beautiful audio recording of the book, in which you use your lifelong skill of accents, voices, and mimicry to impersonate any number of people. There's various American accents, but you also, of course, obviously do Beamer a lot. And it made me wonder, do you have any recordings of his voice?
Yes, I do. I have a recording because we had this idea at one point that we would do a podcast because he was very passionate about doing something about climate change.
Yeah, renewable energy.
Exactly. And he left corporate America and set up a community solar company in Bennington, Vermont, because he wanted to help people who couldn't otherwise afford it have solar. And also he provided, you know, it was a general solar company as well. But he was passionate about renewable energy. He actually said to me one day when he found out that I was a voice artist, I remember on our first date, he said, what do you do? And I said, well, I do cartoons and voices for a living. And he said, can you do some cartoon voices for me now? And I remember thinking, he's a very attractive man. And I think he likes me. The question is, will the squirrel voices be off-putting. But I can't resist. So I said, how do you do? What do you mean? How do I do? How do I do what? How do I do the dishes? How do I do the laundry? Be specific. And then he found out I could do any.
Really, really is a transformation.
And he said, Alison, you must put me in a one-woman show one day. But when you do, you must promise me you won't make me sound English or American. You must promise me you will do my accent exactly as it is. And I promised. And so I did.
You did. And I love the way that you, as Bhima, say your name.
Alison.
Yes. I love it.
When he wasn't calling me Alison, he was calling me beautiful woman. Which, of course, is ridiculous, but
no.
He was biased.
That was actor, voiceover artist, comedian, audiobook narrator, producer, and author Alison Larkin speaking with WAMC's Sarah LaDuke. Her new memoir is Grief, a Comedy. It's out now, both in print and audiobook versions. Last week, we spoke with artist Alison Cornyn about her research into the former New York Training School for Girls in New York's Hudson Valley. Now the site is a prison for men called Hudson Correctional Facility, but from 1904 to 1975, it was the reformatory New York Training School, and before that, it was a women's prison called the Women's House of Refuge. The site has a long history of criminalizing independent behavior in women and girls, which we dove into at length last week. I encourage you to check it out. But Cornyn is also an artist, and she has a new exhibit out with 16 other women aimed at spreading awareness of the New York Training School and a little-known cemetery on the property. After our conversation, I drove up to the church in Statsburg, New York, to check it out in person and speak with the other artists.
Jesse's here, Alison.
The exhibit, called Unearthing the Light, builds on a previous exhibit of Cornyn's and a memorial service she held at the cemetery last year. Back then, she and a group of former students from the New York Training School placed white roses on the graves of at least 14 women, girls, and babies who died while at the school or at the Women's House of Refuge. Some of them died in childbirth, while others succumbed to disease.
This is kind of the impetus for this whole exhibition, thinking about how do we honor the lives that are lost and marginalized and kind of erased and forgotten about. And
footage of that memorial service serves as the starting point for the exhibit, which heavily explores themes of loss, destruction, healing, and remembrance.
And also kind of extending the body into the body of the earth, thinking about kind of the babies and girls being buried in the earth as well, and kind of what that body is like that's holding them.
Can we walk through the whole thing?
Yeah. Okay. At times, Unearthing the Light makes you feel as if you're underground or standing in an open grave. Root drawings by Gillian McDonald are positioned high up on the walls of the church, as if they're dangling above you. A collage by Tanya Marcuse uses photographs of the scraps and eggshells discarded by vultures. And the largest sculpture in the room, a kneeling Mother Earth-like figure by Sandra Harper, is made out of a combination of clay and seaweed. Artist Maggie Simonelli spent months collecting pine needles and researching the Pine Barrens of New Jersey for her piece. The result was an encaustic painting that uses beeswax and bright red homemade pigments to make it look like the pine needles are burning.
What I learned was pine trees need fire to regenerate. So without the fire, the seed cones will not open. So it became a collection of a landscape, the ecosystem that was in balance. So here the fire is actually constructive to the wood. So it's this idea of this natural balance.
The exhibit also includes a surprising amount of digital works. A video in one corner by Rita Perez captures a flower from Hudson Correctional Facility as it slowly withers and fades from a bright green to a dried gold. A video by Nina Sobel plays with the exposure on different photographs and the frequencies of nature sounds like heartbeats to depict a world destroyed that ultimately puts itself back together. Sobel says she made it during the COVID-19 pandemic.
It's a trip of us traveling into space and then being transformed and coming back down to Earth again in a hybrid form, because we are hybrid now that we've been invaded by this virus. We are a transmutation of ourselves that we weren't before, you know?
For all the darkness explored in Unearthing the Light, there is also a lot of love and healing. One piece by Nancy Burson literally uses the word love written in different colors over and over again until the page looks like its own cosmic universe, literally made out of the word love. A small book in a glass case has the words, quote, "I think of you," embroidered across the page by Diana Weimar. In the room's center, visitors are encouraged to memorialize their own lost loved ones. Artist Ophelia Mangan has origami flowers where visitors can write the name of someone they'd like to remember on a piece of paper and fold them up inside. Cornyn says Mangan also held a seed ball workshop earlier this summer where participants could, quote, infuse the memory of a loved one in a ball of clay and seeds and then toss it in their backyards.
She actually has a little poem that you can put your seed in these little bags, and it says, "Find a place in need of some beauty, bask in the glow of remembrance, sow these seeds to bloom and grow."
Unearthing the Light is on view weekends at the church in Statsburg through September 14th. Back in Western Massachusetts, an all-girls boarding school in Pittsfield has been embroiled in allegations of sexual abuse. Survivors are now reacting after an independent investigation corroborated their stories. WAMC's Josh Landis reports, and a warning to our listeners that this story contains upsetting content. If you or someone you love has been impacted by sexual assault or child abuse, RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline is open 24/7 at 1-800-656-HOPE.
In the spring of 2024, Miss Hall School graduates Melissa Ferris and Hillary Simon put faces and names to years of allegations of grooming and rape at the hands of former teacher Matthew Rutledge. Now, a 60-page report by a law firm commissioned by the school supports Ferris and Simon's claims, as well as claims against seven other school employees over the decades since Miss Hall's founding in 1898.
It wasn't surprising, but it was definitely devastating. It was my lived experience, and finally, I saw it put into the record what I've carried in silence for over two decades.
Simon.
The report lays bare decades of abuse and betrayal at Miss Hall's and tells my own story.
In addition to harrowing accounts of abuse at the hands of Rutledge and other staffers tasked with caring for students, the report highlights strenuous efforts from administrators like former head of school Jeannie Norris to crack down on any attempt to call out the malfeasance.
I think what's especially hard for me to come to terms with is that so much of this failure came from women, from people I thought would understand. And I don't know, I'm having a really hard time wrapping my mind around it. It feels like a deeper kind of betrayal. So much of what was shared by students was just dismissed by faculty and staff as mere gossip. And it's extremely belittling and deeply wrong. And I think there's such an irony here that's impossible to ignore, which is that at Miss Hall's, we were taught to use our voices to advocate for ourselves, to have agency, to feel and be empowered. But when we, you know, all of these girls tried to do exactly that, when they reported inappropriate or suspicious behavior, they were totally shut down.
Ferris.
They were literally told, go to your room, write a letter of apology. They were told, you made this up. Over and over again, we were punished for speaking up. And silenced and disempowered.
Ms. Halls confirmed to WAMC that the school's board of trustees is standing by the current head of school, Julia Heaton, and board president, Nancy Ault. That support comes even as the report says school leaders failed for years to act on claims of misconduct, something that still disturbs Ferris.
Julia Heaton and Nancy Ault, I appreciate their acknowledgement of wrongdoing. And there's a part of me that does believe it's sincere, but it doesn't change the fact that they failed to listen when it mattered most. And because of that, many people suffered and felt really hurt. You know, there are a lot of people that are angry that they're staying on, and I can understand why. But I also hope that having lived through this crisis firsthand, having heard survivors' stories directly, including my own, and having apologized for their role in it, they can lead with a greater vigilance and accountability than someone who hasn't experienced it up close. But I would definitely say all eyes are on you.
Ferris and Simon are backing legislative efforts to fill gaps in Massachusetts law that Berkshire County District Attorney Timothy Chagrew claimed made it impossible to prosecute Rutledge after an investigation last year. Simon.
Right now, authority figures and teachers are not able to be held accountable when a student is above the age of consent, which is 16 in Massachusetts. And this case and this report highlights why that is such a dangerous loophole. Students, minors, can't ever consent to sexual contact when the individual is an authority figure. And I think that I have to look at this as like a forward-thinking movement, and it's to protect the next generation. So I'm going to keep speaking out regardless of whether Matthew Rutledge is held accountable. It's about the next generation.
Ferris is still shocked that her credible account of sexual assault did not translate into action by Chagrew's office.
Reporting what happened to me to the police twice took so much out of me. You know, the process, having to relive everything, is absolutely grueling. And then to be told, well, you were 16, you know, the age of consent in Massachusetts, sorry, there's nothing we can do, felt so invalidating and backwards.
The DA's office says it is now reviewing the school commission to lead a law report, which contains multiple references to Rutledge forcing himself on students at Miss Hall's. WAMC asked both survivors what they would say to their younger selves, still trapped in Miss Hall's culture of abuse, silence, and repression. Simon.
But I'm finally reclaiming my voice, and the damage was real, but so is the healing. And I want that message to be louder than the silence ever was.
Ferris.
I'd say, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry so many people failed you. I'm sorry I can't take it all back for you, but if I could, believe me, I would. I love you, and I'll continue to fight for you so that we can heal together. I'd say, you know, you're free now, and you don't have to be afraid anymore. You're safe, and I got you.
Reporting from the WAMC News, Berkshire Bureau at the Beacon Cinema, I'm Josh Landes.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.